I'm talking to Dr. Pradeep Chadha. Dr. Pradeep, can you tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, and yes, a little bit about maybe what made you who you are today?
Thank you, Jared, for having me on your program. Yeah, I come from India initially and originally, where I trained as a doctor, as a medical doctor. And after working there for a few years as a general practitioner, I decided, well, I had the dream that I would be doing psychiatry even a long time ago before that. And the way the Indian system works is I found that there was no way I could do psychiatry or learn psychiatry in India. So I decided it's better that I go offshore. And I came to Ireland. And I remember one of the first choices that we had to make with the medical council was whether you wanted to do other specialties, wanted to work in other specialties other than psychiatry. And within 6 months, I decided of coming here and working in psychiatry, this is where I'm going to stay. So I gave them a notice to say, I'm going to work in psychiatry for as long as I'm here, which was an undertaking which many people would regret, but I had no regrets because I had my eyes set. Because I was curious to see and learn how human mind works. You need to remember, I come from India, and India is a very spiritual place from many perspectives. It's a melting pot of all religions. You will find religions in India that you have never heard of in other parts of the world. For example, Parsis is a group of people who live in India who migrated at some stage from Persia. And they follow Zoroastrianism. Now, Zoroastrianism is unheard of in this part of the world because these people, they came to India when they were being persecuted in Persia. And Sikhism was born in India. Sikhs form a very important segment of Indian population. And they are spread worldwide and they're very hardworking. Sikhs come from the same part of India as I come from Punjab. And because it's a melting point of all cultures, of all religions, especially when you are brought up in a city, like I was brought up in a city, you come with a very open mind. You are curious to learn what these faiths teach you, because I have learned of people from all faiths, prophets and leaders from literally all faiths when I was in primary school. I remember being taught moral science, which is very interesting. At that stage, we didn't understand what it meant, but moral science was a subject that was taught in our school when I was in class 5 or 6. And in moral science, we learned about how we need to behave and what these prophets and these spiritual masters have taught us. And coming from that background, it fascinated me as to how human mind worked. And I had never worked in psychiatry in India. So when I came here and I started to work in psychiatry, I thought I would learn quite a bit about what I had already learned there and add on to my knowledge base with regard to how human mind worked and how spirit worked. By the way, it's very interesting that very few people would know that the word psych, actually P-S-Y-C-H-E, means spirit. And when you talk of psychotherapy, it's actually soul therapy. When you talk of psychiatry, you're talking of soul medicine, soul healing. And that was what fascinated me. So when I came here, I realized there was no talk of any spirituality, no talk of how mind worked or how people behaved or how their behavior could be altered or how what responsibility they had for their behaviors and their thinking. And within about 2 years, I was disillusioned of working here in psychiatry. At that stage, I actually started to think whether I had made a mistake coming into psychiatry, because the whole psychiatric model was and continues to be medical-based. There's a disturbance in your serotonin, in your dopamine receptors, and off you go. There's nothing we can offer at the moment. And you need to take medication for the rest of your life. And it still happens. I come across patients who are told categorically by psychiatrists, by even general practitioners, that they will need to be on medication for the rest of their lives. And these people have not been suffering with something like schizophrenia, for example, which can be understandable. But even with depression, people have been told that. People with obsessive compulsive disorder have been told that. And post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, is something that I found very early on. I was working with Ivor Brown, that trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder was something that not very many people talked of. And it had its own connotation with regard to, again, going by the label industry, if I may call it. When labels are put, then we are looking for particular symptoms and signs for post-traumatic stress disorder. And if you don't have them, then you are not suffering with post-traumatic stress disorder. And with Ivor Brown, I learned that that was doubtful, that people still could come into hospitals and have various kinds of diagnoses that they present with and labels that they present with, but underlying their traumas, their presentations, there would be traumas that no one has talked about, that they never knew impacted on them. They never knew impacted on their present and current mental health state. And as a result of which, they got the treatment of alcohol dependence, depression, generalized anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder. And there were medications specifically set out for each such condition. And then when I worked with Ivor Brown, I decided it was time to change course. I was no longer interested, honestly speaking, in doing any exams at that stage, because my curiosity had been aroused and I lost touch with the, if I may call, the goal, because I never had that goal to pass exams and become a consultant and all that stuff. Because once the curiosity is arisen, then it doesn't end till it is satisfied. So Ivor Brown taught me one of my first exercises or techniques of hypnosis. And as I learned that and became aware that hypnosis was such a powerful tool to heal, my curiosity grew. So what was it in hypnosis that could heal, and what was it different, and how was it different from what we were doing in psychiatry? So I started asking questions, and Ivor was honest enough to tell me that he couldn't teach me more. So I had to learn myself. And that was a very difficult thing to do. Ireland being a small place, I didn't want to go out anywhere, and there were no people to teach me hypnosis. Especially I was interested in learning medical hypnosis because my background was such, and I wanted to use hypnosis for treating medical conditions. But I came across a very interesting man. His name is Joe Keeney. He works in Cork and he runs a school there, hypnosis school. So I started attending his classes, and hypnosis opened my eyes. Now, what he taught was a very stereotyped, typical way how to do what's called as hypnoanalysis. And then he later on moved to NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. But I had enough knowledge by that time to start doing things in a different way. So I set up my own practice at that stage, 1996, I remember, on Drumcondra in Dublin. But I was taught by Joe Keeney, well, understandably, not to take on any psychiatric patients, because that was the way he had trained people, and he didn't want to take risks, and he wanted to remain within his territory of whatever and how he worked, which was understandable. So when I started to work as a hypnotherapist, as a medical hypnotherapist, very soon I realized I have my psychiatric training, I have my psychiatric qualifications, I have experience. I can help people with medication to help them at least reduce medication, if not come off medication. So it was a new challenge for me, and again, I had no mentor at that time, no guide. Ivor Brown continued to supervise me even when I was practicing. It was extremely helpful. And before that, I had actually worked in St. Vincent's Hospital, Fairview, for quite some time, where I had met two very nice psychiatrists who were all pro what I did and what Ivor Brown did. And they had given me a free hand to heal people the way I wanted to. And because I had learnt EMDR at that stage from Ivor Brown, I had those skills. I had hypnotic skills. I had done my diploma in hypnotherapy at that stage. And they gave me a free hand to work with patients the way I wanted, to their advantage and to the patient's advantage and to my advantage. And I learned a lot. These consultants were Brian McCaffrey and Dr. Jim O'Boyle, who are both retired now. And I have a great regard for both of them. So when I set up my practice and started to see patients now who were on psychiatric drugs, it was, again, a very different learning curve for me, because I was quite anxious. I was taking a sort of a risk, but not taking a risk. And that's another way I learned of how to do things in life, that you master a particular skill in such a way that when you take the next step, and if you have creativity to take the next step, then you know pretty well what the next step is going to unfold and how it's going to unfold. So based on that principle, once I had mastered what I was doing, I decided to start taking people on with medication. And I was quite anxious at that time, because I had learned, I had come across certain papers when I was working in St. Vincent's Fairview, which actually opened my eyes that there could be a different way to do things, which could be drugless, which could be medication free. And one of the papers I remember was on something like when pregnant women were trained for childbirth to deliver babies. They were taught two, they were a group of two groups of women. One was taught relaxation, simple relaxation as we would know of it, breathing relaxation. And the other group was taught how to increase their tension first before they would relax. And I remember reading that paper. The researchers found that the ones who could increase their tension were the ones who did very well, better than the others who were doing relaxation while childbirth. And that sparked a very important question in my mind. So what was it that was happening when they were getting tensed up that worked better than the ones that they were relaxing? And then I also came across, well, I was reading my medical textbook one day, physiology. And it suddenly stuck me as I was reading how the brain worked. I read a section again, after having done all my medicine and everything, that when, so for example, when you move a finger of your hand and you do it deliberately and you decide that you are going to move your finger, the brain has actually done that a split second before. So the brain is already primed to do what you will be doing in a short while. That was fascinating, because that meant that the brain could be convinced to do something that you intended to do, but you may not do actually in behavior, which simply meant that imagery was going to be a very important segment, or it could be a part of healing process. Well, as I had learned hypnosis and imagery was only a small part of it, I had also learned by that time, Milton Erickson was a psychiatrist, hypnotherapist in the United States, and he's still considered a legend, because his techniques have never been duplicated, studied a lot, but not duplicated the way he did it. He was a very smart psychiatrist, and he did hypnosis in a totally non-hypnotic way. You could have your eyes open and he would give you instructions and you would never realize or know that you were hypnotized, and he would get the clinical effect of that hypnosis. And he fascinated me. But what I learned from his books and his mechanism, because if you look into anything, into any process or any procedure or any problem, usually there are patterns that are repeated. And that's how people behave. They behave in patterns, they repeat patterns. And these patterns apply to everything in life. So I was looking at the patterns of what Milton Erickson did. And my interpretation was very simple. Whatever he did, he first made things worse. So he first made things worse, and then things became better. And that fitted into what I was talking about earlier about those pregnant women who were delivering babies, one with increased tension and one with simple relaxation. And that fitted because here these women were increasing the tension in their body, and the tension would fall spontaneously because they couldn't hold onto the tension for a long time. And as a result of which, they would become relaxed. And this is the principle on which Milton Erickson's techniques are based on. Increasing the tension first, and then the tension gets released spontaneously. And that was a very big cue for me, and especially when that imagery thing came up, that the brain was activated a split second before the action actually happened. That made me think, why can't we have a simple process by which a person can deal with their traumas in imagination, increasing their tension, because trauma creates tension, increasing their tension to the extent that the tension starts to fall. I had to formulate a theory. So for first 3 years of my work, I just worked on the basis, and my learning curve was very steep at that time. I remember what I learned in first 3 years of my practice, I have not learned in the rest of the years. But those 3 years opened my eyes and taught me so much. And there, it revealed to me that there was a pattern that worked in human behavior and human thoughts. And that's how and why people became mentally unwell. And now for me, the question was whether we can apply that principle to heal people. Now, here I would like to mention that whatever I have been stating with regard to increasing tension and decreasing tension, it fits into the stress theory. And stress is very much talked about subject these days, because in every aspect of life, whenever there is a problem, health problem, stress is discussed and brought up. But what is stress at the end of the day? In very simple terms, it's fight or flee. Fight or flee. That's how people usually know of it. But what happens in that fight or flee? We need to appreciate that our nervous system and our hormonal systems play a very important role in integrating the rest of the 8 organ systems in the body. So our digestive system, our sensory system, our circulatory system, reproductive system, excretory system, every system is coordinated by the nervous system and the endocrine system. Now, the nervous system, broadly speaking, the part that controls all the organs of the body is called as the autonomic nervous system. And the autonomic nervous system, as the name implies, is automatic. When I was in medical school, I understood that autonomic nervous system was an involuntary system. You couldn't control it. And that was, again, a mystery for me. Why can't you control it? But when I read literature, coming from India, I was used to hear about particular sage or particular hermit or whoever stopping their heartbeat. And I used to wonder why and how did that happen. And actually, there are documented papers, if someone can look into them. I remember a hermit was put down into a hole in the ground, attached to the various contraptions, and the scientists were surprised to see his heart rate coming to zero. And then it became very, zero means sporadic. And when this person was taken out, after a few hours, he was hale and hearty, and the heartbeat came back to normal. And that used to fascinate me as to how that was possible. So when the autonomic system came to my attention, I looked at it again, and I realized that there are two parts of the nervous system, autonomic nervous system. One is called the sympathetic, and the other one is called the parasympathetic. Now, the stress and the fight and flee system that we talk about refers 100% to the sympathetic system. And no one talks of the parasympathetic system. Meditation was first researched in 1970s, 1980s, and it was done after a lot of persuasion by people who were doing TM, Transcendental Meditation, in California at some stage. And Herbert Benson of Harvard University was literally cajoled into doing his research by this group, and he thought that it was a hanky-panky kind of a business, till he started to do research and his eyes opened wider than before, and he ended up writing two books, The Relaxation Response and so on. But what he describes in his experiments was revealing that meditation worked on the parasympathetic system. And this was the first time that someone had brought up that issue. So on one side, you have the parasympathetic system, which is the relaxation system. And on the other side, you have the sympathetic system or the stress system. And these two systems, what I learned in my firsthand experience, they played a dance. And when I realized they played a dance, then I needed to know the movements of the dance. And that was my next project. So after my first 3 years were over, once I had become confident that this was the way the sympathetic system, the autonomic system worked, the parasympathetic and the sympathetic system actually worked on a feedback mechanism basis. One fed into the other. It's just like any other system in the body. Just like one hormone, say hormone A, when it reaches a particular level of concentration, it starts to affect hormone B. And if hormone A is at its peak, then hormone B starts to counteract it and brings down the level of hormone A till hormone B reaches its peak and hormone A again takes over. And this is the feedback way in which hormonal system works. The autonomic nervous system works the same way, exactly the same way. So if you were to increase your tension, increasing your sympathetic tone, somehow the parasympathetic system gets activated. And the same way happens with the parasympathetic system. The parasympathetic system, when it's activated too much, then it stimulates the sympathetic system. And a classic example of that is what people would know of, what is called as the paradoxical behavior of drugs, paradoxical effect of drugs. And what that simply means is that people who have ADHD, for example, hyperactivity, they are treated with stimulants. And as they are treated with stimulants, they actually calm down. This is a classic example of how the sympathetic system operates. The sympathetic tone is increased to that extent that it cannot sustain it anymore and it calms down. The other example is that in hypoactive children, autistic children, tranquilizers are given as treatment. The tranquilizers in a person who would be not autistic would cause drowsiness. Whereas in autistic children, it has the reverse effect. So it stimulates the child and the child becomes more active. Now, when I became aware of it, there are other examples as well of how the feedback system works. But this is a classic example of and very well known. And it is called as the paradoxical effect of drugs. And on that basis, I wrote a paper in 2000 that there was nothing paradoxical about it. These two systems worked the way they needed to. They worked on a feedback basis. And I explained in that paper how if you increase the sympathetic tone, you can actually heal emotional trauma easily. More easily as compared to if you would just be stimulating the parasympathetic system by meditation or by hypnosis. And that actually opened a whole new avenue of treatment for me. And I started to call myself as a drugless practitioner. But then the next goalpost for me was to appreciate, and the question was, how do medication work? Psychiatric drugs work. And how do psychiatric drugs work so that they can be used usefully along with this autonomic dance? So I realized, based on my experience, I had realized that what medications do is they stifle you, they stifle your emotions, they suppress your emotions, they suppress your feelings. And if we start the sympathetic, the autonomic dance, then the emotions start to become alive. So when you are doing emotive therapy of any kind, you are making the person feel the pain, the grief, the trauma. And the medications, the psychiatric drugs, would have the opposite effect. And that opened a new door for me. So if I was to prescribe drugs for someone who is depressed, then the depression gets suppressed because the grief, trauma, anger gets suppressed. And the person gets a false feeling of feeling better. But as soon as the person comes off the medication, the grief, trauma, and anger strikes again. So how can we use the two to the benefit of people? So I started to experiment with that and learned firsthand that the way the medications are advocated to be reduced by pharmaceutical companies when a person gets better on them is not the way that the body is going to handle them when you are doing therapy. And that's the reason why when people become depressed and when they come off medication, they remain well for a little while and then they become depressed again and they need to be put on medication again. So what's the solution? The solution basically was I would help them, for example, a person with depression, I would help them reduce a little bit of medication and wait for the emotional feeling to be experienced, the trauma to be experienced, the anger to be experienced, and help them work through that trauma, that anger, that grief with imagery. And then when they are settled again, then make the second reduction. And so on and so forth. So each time the medication would be reduced a little bit, we would wait till the upheaval, the emotional upheaval would take place. And then after they are settled, we would make another reduction. And lo and behold, that was another door opened. And here was a protocol that was developed in which you could very slowly and gradually reduce your medication, deal with your emotional traumas, and then reduce further medication till you can come off it successfully. Now, mind you, it's something that can be easily done, say, in depression, not easily done in schizophrenia, for example. Schizophrenia is a very different game, ball game. But as time has gone on, I have learned that in my view, some people call it simplistic view. It may be simplistic, all right, but it works for me and it works for my clients. There are only three kinds of issues that people usually struggle with when they are having a mental illness. They are either dealing with unresolved or struggling with unresolved grief, and they are struggling with anger issues that they cannot shift and not forgive, and trauma issues. Trauma can be as simple as a small child being screamed at by a teacher. Trauma can be as severe as a person seeing, a soldier seeing his dead comrades who were firing the guns a moment ago next to him, and now they're dead. Shattered bodies, limbs spread out on the battlefield, and so on and so forth. So trauma is a very subjective kind of an experience. And that's the reason why, because I deal with or help people deal with their subjective emotions, I call this work as subjective emotive brief therapy. As a psychiatrist, we are taught to be objective about how a person presents, and we make a label and we start giving medication. In psychotherapy and the work that I do, it's totally opposite. I do not mind what label the person carries. What I'm more bothered about is how does this person feel about a particular issue in life? For example, if a person feels that they have been abused emotionally, physically, or sexually, and in my objective view, maybe that was a misinterpretation on their behalf. I'm not going to argue with them that this happened or not happened. I see it my job to help them process and reduce their pain and suffering that they're going through, for which I would use imagery and simple breathing exercises. And for those of the listeners who are interested in what I do, my website is www.brclinicstresscenter.com. And my contact numbers are given there.
Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome, Jared. I hope it helps.